War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome back to the Pacific Theater on Film. This is your host, James, and I have with me, as always, Mr. Sean McIver. How are you, Sir Sean?
I'm doing well.
All right, very good. Well, Sean is especially excited this time because we're doing one of his all-time favorite movies. This is the second, as I mentioned last time. Well, as I mentioned, we are doing a three-part miniseries of classic 1950s naval movies, all of which have some of the greatest names in Hollywood history starring in them. And so this is the second of the three. And this is Mr. Roberts from 1955. The length is 2 hours and 3 minutes. The ratings are very high on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics gave it 93% positive, and the audience gave it 85%. They kind of messed up on the fit. They're 15% of them. Don't know what they're talking about. Anyway,
yeah, that's right. they don't like old movies.
Yeah.
I think there's a percentage of Rotten Tomato watchers that just don't like old movies, and they just, no matter what, they rate old movies lower.
Yeah. Well, I can relate to that, but I'm starting to gain a new appreciation for them thanks to movies like this one. The average on IMDb is 7.7 out of 10. That's a solid rating. And Mr. Roberts was directed by the great legendary director who we've already seen once before, John Ford, assisted by Mervyn LeRoy. And Sean will have more to say about both of them a little bit later. And the stars are, I mean, especially the first three, these are all absolute legends of Hollywood. Henry Fonda, Jack Lemmon, James Cagney, also William Powell, Ward Bond, and Betsy Palmer. It's based on the 1946 novel and 1948 Broadway play of the same name. And it was very well received at the time, just as it is today. Mr. Roberts was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor for Jack Lemmon, who won the award, and Best Sound Recording. It also won the award for Best Written American Comedy from the Writers Guild of America. And yes, you heard me correctly. This one is a comedy. We're definitely having a change of pace here, aren't we, Sean?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that Mr. Roberts has a very similar origin to the Caine Mutiny, which we talked about last time. It was like the Caine Mutiny. It was a popular novel. It was written by an author named Thomas Hagen, and it was written in 1940, published in 1946. And this novel was based on his experiences in World War II. And then it was subsequently adapted into a very popular Broadway play. So very similar in origin to the Caine Mutiny, just a different tone to the story.
Very different.
Yeah, much more comic. I think, and actually, it also is relatively similar to a movie which we don't talk about, we won't be covering, but South Pacific, the musical, was based on a novel by James Michener called Tales of the South Pacific, and based on his experiences as a supply officer during World War II. So I think this movie has a lot, and story is a lot more in tone with the South Pacific than it does the Caine Mutiny, but it certainly covers some of the same ground.
Yeah, so, definitely. Okay, what else you got? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so his background. So Hagen had served as a junior officer on board cargo ships in the South Pacific, and he based the characters and some of the events on real life experiences and even used some names. Apparently, the real life Pulver, Ensign Pulver, was a career Navy man who threatened to sue him for including his name
in
the story. Mr. Roberts was his only novel. He died at the age of 30 in 1949. Drowning in his bathtub after an overdose of sleeping pills. So unfortunately, a sad life for Mr. Hagen, and he actually was suffering from writer's block when he passed away. So tragic story there. Now, the play was a great success on Broadway. It starred Henry Fonda, who was a Hollywood star who had left Hollywood to perform in this play, left a contract. And he was gone from Hollywood for about 8 years. It ran for 1,157 performances. Won the Tony Award in 1948 for the best play, and it earned Henry Fonda a Best Actor Tony as well. So Warner Brothers Pictures, they picked up the option for a film version of the play. They didn't want to cast Henry Fonda. They felt he was too old and he was no longer a box office draw by the mid-50s because he had been gone. He'd been in Broadway. They wanted to cast either William Holden or Marlon Brando for the role, which, you know, you think, oh, Marlon Brando. But remember, 1955, he was a very young, handsome young actor. So, but the John Ford, who was tapped to direct the film, he insisted that Henry Fonda was the only person that he wanted for the part of Mr. Roberts. He had directed Fonda in a number of great films in the 1930s and 40s, and Young Mr. Lincoln, The Grapes of Wrath, Drums Along the Mohawk, My Darling Clementine, and Fort Apache. So he had a track record with Henry Fonda, but he also knew that Fonda knew the part backwards and forwards. The other actors in the film, Jack Lemmon, who is probably my favorite actor of the time period. He just started appearing in films. He was mostly known as a radio and Broadway actor and a TV actor at the time. And he was a comedic actor, obviously. Ford cast Jack Lemmon after seeing a screen test he did for Columbia Pictures, where Lemmon was under contract, but he had a special deal where he was able to do other projects like plays and TV shows and even films for other studios. So Ford was able to get Warner to bring Lemmon over, to get loaned over to work on this film. And then William Powell is probably as famous a Hollywood legend as those other three guys. He was famous as for his partnership with Myrna Loy. They were Nick and Nora Charles in the Thin Man series. So the Thin Man movies in the 1930s were a husband and wife sort of socialite slash detective team. And they did a number of those movies. And those movies are fantastic. If you ever want to watch screwball comedy with a little bit of film noir mixed in, go watch the Thin Man movies. By the 1940s, his health was suffering. He was older and he could no longer play the romantic lead by the 1950s. And so Mr. Roberts is actually his last film, unfortunately. And then the rest of the cast, you mentioned Ward Bond, and we've talked extensively about my love for Ward Bond, my favorite character actor of all time. He's in the film, Harry Carey Jr., Jack Pinnock. These are all guys and men that were in John Ford's stock company. And we've talked about his stock company of regular actors who he cast in supporting roles in films. Another character that you see in there, the real handsome young sailor that meets the nice island girl when they're on shore leave, that's John Wayne's son, Patrick. And he was often in John Ford's films. And then John Ford's son-in-law, Ken Curtis, he's the sailor who keeps getting the letters from Mr. Roberts to send off. That's Ken Curtis. He was John Ford's son-in-law. And if you look at him, you see a handsome young guy, and you saw him in The Searchers and in other John Ford movies, but fast forward about 15 years later with a grizzled beard and a crooked hat, and you see Festus from Gunsmoke. So Ken Curtis was on Gunsmoke for probably 20 years, for the whole length of the show. So lots of familiar faces if you watch this film.
Wow, I didn't even know some of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
All right, so
watch the John Ford movies, you'll see these faces popping up again and again and again. So
yeah.
But I mean, it made sense. He liked to work with the same people, especially his sporting characters. He knew he could bring in his crew, his group of people, and plug them right in where he wanted them to be, and that they knew how to work for him. So that was a kind of a technique that he had, and it worked. It works very well.
Yeah, it makes total sense. You don't have to learn new personalities, new methods of working or whatever. You've already got all these, you know these guys, so you know how to work with them, how to treat them.
Exactly.
Okay, are you ready? Shall we jump into the plot summary? All right, so as is often the case in these older movies, there's an opening title, and this one begins by saying, this story takes place in the waning days of the Second World War aboard a Navy cargo ship operating in the back areas of the Pacific. In the Navy Register, it is listed as the Reluctant, but to its crew, it is known as the Bucket. The man of the Navy cargo ship, USS Reluctant, are hard at work moving supplies and resupplying other ships of the U.S. Navy. Lieutenant Commander Morton, who is the captain of the ship, that's James Cagney. He's a mean-spirited, exacting, and tyrannical officer. Recently, the Reluctant was recognized for moving the most cargo of any resupply ship in the fleet. The reward for their efforts is a single palm tree, which was given to Morton. The tree is displayed proudly on the foredeck by Captain Morton, And the result of the recognition is that the captain has now become more tyrannical than ever. He absolutely refuses to let the crew have a standard liberty.
Surely.
So, yeah, what about this? Is this kind of a stock character, would you say, Sean, that, you know, the cruel captain?
It's Captain Queeg. It's way back to Captain Bligh from Mutiny on the Bounty. You know, it's a little bit of Captain Ahab as well. So, you know, it's that character. But apparently Hagen had a real commander of a ship who was a bit of a pain to deal with. And they really did get a palm tree for moving the most cargo of any supply ship.
What a great incident.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, yes, it's funny because all three of these movies we're doing, these naval movies from the 50s, have a captain that's, if not tyrannical, then just weird, you know?
Driven. Yeah, I think, and that's the thing. You're going to find three different facets of that perception. This guy, Morton, is a martinet. He's an absolute tyrant, but it's okay because it's a comedy. Queeg was, you know, the Navy was concerned about Queeg, you know, in the book. Captain Queeg in the Kane Mutiny was actually a tyrant, was just insane. And the Navy wanted to make sure that it was not perceived that they had crazy officers. It was battle fatigue. So that's why they made some changes in the film. So, but you know, Cagney's not nuts. He's just mean. And so the irony is, of course, John Ford had a reputation for being just more like Morton than he did for being like Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, that's funny.
Right.
In the opening scene, there's an announcement. It's funny, these announcements keep coming on in this
group. It reminds me of MASH. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the movie MASH, the announcements MASH coming in to kind of narrate things.
Right. Now hear this. Now hear this. You can tell that they're so excited to be making the announcements. But
yeah,
the announcement comes across saying that because another cigarette butt has been found in the container of the palm tree, there will be no movies again that night. So somebody had the gall to throw a cigarette butt into the palm tree's container. And so no movies. The captain's going to cancel the movies. Then we're introduced to our main character, Lieutenant Junior Grade Doug Roberts. That is, of course, Henry Fonda. And Mr. Roberts, as they call him, is well-liked by the entire crew. And he acts as a sort of liaison between the crew and their captain. His duty is to keep the men engaged while they complete their missions. But he's micromanaged by the captain. Robert's best friend on the ship and confidant is Doc, who is the ship's doctor. That is William Powell's character. And we see that Roberts has recently seen a convoy of American warships, and it reminded him of how much he dislikes his current assignment. He feels, Roberts does, he knows that the Pacific War is winding down, and he feels like he'll never have the chance to serve in naval combat. That's a common thing we see in a lot of movies like this, where somebody wants to get into combat, not just World War II movies, but movies in all kinds of wars. And he's also become quite fed up with the captain's oppressive attitude, and he's written a number of letters to the captain requesting transfer to a combat vessel, all of which have gone unfulfilled by the captain. So he decides to write another one. Give him points for perseverance, right, Sean?
Yeah, but this one he kind of reads it as like it's a lot more strongly worded. I think this is also the scene where I think I quoted last time when we talked about the Kane Mutiny, and Doc says that there's no more, you know, there's no more godlike person on earth than a captain of a ship.
Right.
But this is the scene, I think also, if it's not this one, it's another conversation they have where Roberts tells Doc the real enemy is boredom and malaise. That's the real enemy of the men in this war. And it reminds me in James Michener's Tales of the South Pacific, where he talks about the waiting, the timeless, repetitive waiting. And if you read, so Max Hastings wrote a magnificent book about the last years of the Pacific War. It's called Retribution. And he says that there were 1.25 million Americans serving in the Pacific and the Asian theaters. Now, over 40% of these saw no action at all. And he said, quote, working in the vast support organizations necessary to maintain armies, fleets, and air forces thousands of miles from home. So that's the very definition of what the Reluctant and its crew is doing. They are nowhere near the combat zone, but they have a vital role. They have a very critical and important role. It just doesn't seem like it because it's a tedious drudgery work. But that's, you know, that's something to think about as you think about you know, those who were in combat, and it's estimated that maybe 35% of enlisted men and 40% of American officers served combat in some role. But in the Pacific, it was very different than in the European theater, in that if you were in combat, quote unquote, like I said about my great uncle, who was, you know, a machinist in a destroyer escort. They were at the Battle of Leyte Gulf. He couldn't tell me anything about it because his battle station was down in the, you know, in the belly of the ship. And so unless you actually were on a naval ship, on a gun firing, aircraft gun firing or in an airplane, or one of the Marines or soldiers going onto shore, you know, your combat role, even if you were in combat, you may not have actually experienced much of it. So there's a lot of men and women who served in the war in the Pacific who just never saw the war, so to speak. What they saw was that waiting and that timeless, repetitive waiting.
Yeah, and Roberts' friends, I don't want to get too far ahead, but they try to convince him of, you know, he's how important his service is and how he doesn't need to be in combat, but he's just determined. He's determined to be in it. Do we need to talk about, let's see, we haven't had Cagney or Henry Fonda. You want to just talk a little bit about them? I mean, most people know who they are, but there may be a few
Henry Fonda was a major star in the 1930s and 40s. The best movie about Abraham Lincoln ever made was a John Ford movie called Young Mr. Lincoln, and Henry Fonda played him. If you're a history buff and you have not seen that movie, you need to seek it out because it's a magnificent film. He was in a number of great films. The Grapes of Wrath is one of the classics, but he'd walked away from Hollywood because he was tired of the system. And so he went back to performing in plays. So he was 49 years old when he made this movie. He was actually a little old for the part of a lieutenant.
Yeah, well, that's way too old to be a lieutenant junior.
Right. But again, he knew the part. You know, he knew the part backwards and forwards. So, you know, there's no reason not to cast him in this film. It's like the decision, you know, that people tried to make to not cast the Music Man, you know, with Robert Preston as the Music Man. And everyone said, they offered it to Cary Grant. And he said, "You're insane. Bob Powell is the man to play." Bob Preston is the man to play. So, and then Jimmy Cagney, of course, was another famous actor going back to the 1920s. He was a star even at the end of the silent era, but he was, of course, famous as a tough guy actor, but he was also a singer and a dancer. And he did Yankee Doodle Dandy, where he played singer and stage impresario George Cahan. So he was a major star at that time as well. It was a big performance from him as well.
All right. So now we're going to be introduced to another one of Mr. Roberts' closer friends, and that's Chief Petty Officer Doughty, played by Ward Bond, who we've already spoken about quite a bit.
He's the chief of the boat.
Chief of the boat. He runs the place, basically.
Yeah.
He encourages Mr. Roberts to keep trying to get the transfer, and he agrees to type his request. Many sailors report to Doc. This is kind of funny, claiming to be sick. What was the duty they had? They had some particular duty.
Most duty. They were just gold workers. They were trying to get out of whatever duty that they had.
The doc says, "Oh, it must be duty day or something." And he gives them aspirin, and they're all faking pretty much, but they're just bored with the tedium of their daily routine. Then sometimes the men laze around. Sometimes they get in fights. But one day their boredom is broken up when one of the men discovers, using some binoculars, that there are nurses. This is really the funny part. There are nurses taking showers in the hospital across the harbor. And before long, several of the young men are watching the nurses through the binoculars. One of them even has a telescope. But when the captain appears, they scramble back to their assigned work. They had something like Code Red, or they have some, what is it they say? I forgot it. I watched it about a week ago. Some code phrase when the captain's coming.
He keeps walking by and they keep, because what they're doing is they're supposed to be scraping the deck, and one of them is supposed to be cleaning all the binoculars and the rangefinders. And there's one telescope that they're using.
Mm-hmm. And then they get into a fight, which Mr. Roberts breaks up. So talk about this scene, Sean.
It's just a hilarious scene. I mean, it's straight out of the play. You know, these are young men.
haven't seen a woman for a long time.
They haven't seen a woman for a long time. They haven't been off that ship for a long time. So it's just depicting just how stir crazy they're getting. And then also Roberts gets in an argument with the captain because the men are have duty in the hold, in the ship's hold, and they and the captain's standing orders is no one can be shirtless. Everyone has to wear a shirt, has to be tucked in, yada yada yada. All the things Captain Queeg said, you know. But he's like, it's hot down there. Can we not take off our shirts? And he says, sorry, can't, you know, we can't do it. So it's a good scene
later,
though. It's
later
really
he lets them and he gets into trouble for it.
Yeah, he gets into trouble whenever he tries to do anything to make things easier on the men, he gets in trouble.
Yeah, Mr. Roberts is a very kind-hearted man, whereas the captain is definitely not.
Yeah.
And the captain has, I mean, his lack of kindness and his strictness, he's got some issues, but we'll talk about those a little bit. All right, so then we're introduced to another one of the main characters and a friend of Mr. Roberts, maybe his closest friend, younger man. This is Ensign Frank Thurlow Pulver, played by a very young Jack Lemmon. You know, I had not seen this movie until we started preparing for this series, Sean, and I'm so glad that we did this, and I'm so glad I was able to watch it, because I always just think of Jack Lemmon as this really old man. It's funny. Yeah. But he's so young in this.
He's young, like, yeah.
And it just and looks like a different man almost.
I love Jack Lemmon so much that I often go through my day, especially when I'm in a particularly good mood, singing yatta-dee, yatta-da, yatta-dee, yatta-da.
Yeah. That's the song listener that he keeps humming
and,
the
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So Mr. Roberts, he likes Pulver a lot. He really likes him, but he's quick to point out that Pulver isn't a very effective leader. He's a disorganized person in general. He talks about how he sleeps 16 hours a day.
Yeah, I think he says he's the laziest person alive.
Hides out from the captain. The captain barely even knows that he exists.
Right.
And Pulver despises the captain as much as the rest of the crew, and he often talks about schemes to annoy him, play tricks on him, but he never follows through on any of them.
And he says he wants to put some ball bearings in the wardrobe above the captain's bed, above his bunk.
Yeah. Make him go nuts. He's got all these devious schemes, but he just doesn't have the guts to do them. And one day he meets the captain face to face and he cowers before him. And before long, the ship is due to make port on a small Pacific island, one where there is a full hospital.
Where the nurses are. Where they're taking their showers. Yeah,
that's the same one where they've been watching. And Pulver sees his chance to find a pretty nurse, possibly woo her. He visits the hospital. He meets a nurse and invites her to tour the ship. And she agrees if he has scotch.
Yeah, he's got a bottle of scotch. She says she'll come to be there. So
that's so funny. And he says, oh, I do. And it's actually Mr. Roberts' scotch. But what he doesn't realize, he goes through Mr. Roberts' locker looking for a shoebox which had the bottle of scotch. And it's gone. He can't find it. Mr. Roberts has given it away. What was the exact situation?
He gave it to the, I want to say it was like the, whoever it was that was responsible for giving assignments out. And he traded him, he sent him a bottle of scotch on behalf of the captain. And so that he could get sent to one of the standard places where they have shore leave. One of the standard islands mm-hmm. where there's shore leave. So he's trying to go around the captain by getting orders to go to a place where they have, where they can do a liberty. Mm-hmm. And the captain just can't say no. So,
right. But while he's looking for that bottle of scotch and not finding it, he hears that Mr. Roberts has once again requested a transfer and Pulver doesn't want him to go. So Pulver finds the letter through which he's requesting the transfer and he hides it. Then Mr. Roberts comes back and he learns that Pulver has invited a nurse to the ship, promising her scotch, but there is no scotch, as we've already seen. So Doc and Mr. Roberts decide to help Pulver by making scotch out of grain alcohol, Coca-Cola, that is, iodine, and hair tonic.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that Powell says, I always thought that scotch had an iodine taste to it.
Yeah, it's just really... it's
because they originally had grain alcohol. It was just... clear, ever clear, basically. And Pulver had the Coca-Cola. He had a bottle of Coca-Cola stashed in his footlocker that he was saving. Although I was like, A, it must be flat, and B, it's not cold. But yeah. So yeah, the hair tonic is the best part.
Yeah. And it works. It turns out pretty close. So
yeah.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors. Pulver then asks Roberts what he thinks of him. And Roberts tells him straight up, "You're likable, but you're hapless, you're disorganized, you're lazy." Roberts tells Pulver the first time he finishes something that he starts, you know, that one of these teams, if he carries it out, he will respect him as a man. And Mr. Roberts finds out that Pulver has hidden his letter requesting a transfer, and he takes it back. And Doc thinks that Roberts is foolish for requesting a transfer, of course. So then we touched on that earlier. Not everybody has Mr. Roberts's burning desire to be in combat. Especially not Pulver.
Pulver absolutely does not want to be anywhere close to combat. He doesn't even really want to be in the Navy.
Right. So it's a touching scene. There's some good, you know, banter back and forth between the characters, and they have personality. They have depth. You know, they're not cardboard cutout characters like some of the movies we've seen. But anyway, you want to say anything else on that?
No, it's just one of my favorite scenes.
All right. So
making the scotch is just,
yes, making scotch. Okay. The next day, while Mr. Roberts is supervising a supply distribution, the captain summons him. And he says, I can't, I'm busy. And this makes the captain furious. And he goes to Roberts and he berates him for the language that he used in his last request for transfer. Mr. Roberts he thought he would be more likely to get a transfer. Maybe not. I don't know. But he used the word disharmony. He said that if there's disharmony among the crew with him being there, and so that's a reason he needed to be transferred off. And this, of course, made the captain furious. Captain Morton demands that Roberts change the wording, but he refuses. And then the captain says, if Roberts ever requests transfer again, he will regret it. And he says it almost just like that. Morton then sentences Roberts to 10 days in his cabin for giving away oranges. That's another thing he did. The captain had said not to, but he did it anyway. Compliments of the captain for a supply. They came up and said they needed some fresh fruit. And Pulver appears, and this is a hilarious scene. Pulver, the captain's there, and Pulver tries to disappear. He tries to run off, and the captain says, "Get back here." And then he praises him for good work.
Yeah, his shirts are always starched.
He's a laundry officer, right? That's kind of funny. And then Pulver, Ensign Pulver, prepares for the nurse's arrival. He invites this one nurse, but when she arrives, she's brought her entire crew with her, several assistant nurses, and that ruins any chance that Pulver has at romance. So he introduces the nurses to Mr. Roberts. And by the way, Pulver has told him that he is the XO and Roberts is the morale and laundry officer. So he's trying to make himself be more impressive to these nurses. He takes them on a tour of the ship. But during the tour, the nurses realize that the men could see into their showers with the binoculars. And that kind of leave right away, as they say, hang window curtains.
Yeah.
All right.
Pulver has all these pillows that he puts on his bunk.
Right.
And like, they're just in horribly poor taste. Like one of them has a picture of the Arizona on it. It's just awful. Man. It's just terrible.
It's just a doofus in some ways. It's funny.
Right.
All right. So let's see. Okay. So Roberts goes over to the captain's headquarters. He requests liberty for the crew. And the captain allows the ship to make port at Elysium, which is an island, tropical paradise. But then he announces that the Liberty has been canceled. And this just really sets off Mr. Roberts. He's infuriated. He storms in the captain's quarters and he demands to know why the Liberty was canceled. He insults the captain. The captain threatens him with court-martial. And then the captain tells Mr. Roberts a bit of his own history. He talks about he was a busboy for several years. He received poor treatment from his customers. Then he became a ship steward and the poor treatment continued. And he worked his way up through the ranks. He did not go to college, and he's kind of an old Navy kind of guy. And he sees Mr. Roberts, who is a college graduate, as a representative of those who treated him badly as a youth. And now he seeks to pay them back. So essentially, the captain is trying to get back at all the people that mistreated him through Mr. Roberts.
Yeah. And he's got a kind of a grudge against the Navy because he was not in the Navy before. He was in the Merchant Marine. Mm-hmm. So during the war, experienced ship captains and crews were actually taken from the Merchant Marine and brought into the military transport command in the Navy, the Navy's transport command, because they needed experienced naval captains for warships. So that's why a number of these cargo ships had merchant marine captains and officers and crews. And that's what Morton was. He actually mentions earlier, he did things different in the merchant marine. You respected your captain and that sort of things. And he's just a blowhard. But, he does not like Roberts because of, he's a college boy and he has a prejudice against that.
Yeah. And so then the captain decides to cut a deal with Mr. Roberts. He says he will grant them liberty if Mr. Roberts will stop his efforts to obtain a transfer and if he'll become a model officer. He wants him to become more of a by-the-book leader. He wants to work the crew to their limits. So no more Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Soft Guy. And Roberts has no choice, and he agrees. So the captain then allows the crew to go on liberty. And do they ever go on liberty? They do it in style. Many of the crew become highly drunk, raucous, and destructive on the island. Many of them are arrested and brought back to the ship by army MPs.
They have to be... A number of them have to be hauled aboard on a cargo net with a crane.
They're so drunk. They can't even walk. They're too drunk. That's a great scene. In some cases, Roberts lets them go right back out again. And then he tells Doc that for the first time, the men of the ship are really a crew, not just individuals. And some of the men break into the home of the French colonial governor and they wreak havoc there. A small detachment of army MPs show up and form a cordon around the ship, preventing any other men from leaving. And the commanding officer has requested that Captain Morton see the admiral stationed on the island in the morning. So he's in big trouble. And obviously, you can guess this captain is not going to be happy about it.
This is one of the funniest scenes in movie history. The MP is played by Martin Miller, and we'll see him later in an actually earlier film, The Sands of Iwo Jima, when he was a very young actor. But if you're a fan of TV Land, you've seen Route 66 and Adam 12, you've seen Martin Miller. He was the star of both of those shows. He plays an Alabama Army lieutenant who's in charge of the MPs, and he talks with the drawl, and he says, if it makes you feel any better, Admiral Wentworth said this is the worst ship he's ever seen in his entire naval career.
Yeah, that makes me feel better.
Yeah. It's just hilarious. They threw a bust of Balzac, the French writer, out the window. The cab driver told him it was a place, what they call it in Alabama. Well, they call it the same as in Nebraska.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's just a great, hilarious scene that is just so funny. It's just chaos. It's like a Marx Brothers scene.
Yeah. Well, Captain Morton returns from the meeting furious. He and the crew have been ordered to leave port immediately. So bad that they have to shove off. He commands Roberts to make good on his promise of becoming a stricter officer, which Mr. Roberts does. For example, when one of the crew, a man named Dolan, approaches Roberts with what may be good news, that officers that have a requisite number of months experience may apply for transfer uncontested, which you'd think that would make Mr. Roberts happy, but instead he angrily threatens to put Dolan on report. Snaps at him. Pulver, Doc, and several crewmen discuss the change in Roberts, which they do not understand. And this makes Mr. Roberts upset. He's very upset by the fact that he snapped at this man, and he's upset that he had to enforce discipline when a crew member didn't deserve it. So he has another talk with Doc. Doc tries to reason with Mr. Roberts, and Mr. Roberts does not reveal the deal he'd made with the captain. And just then, Pulver bursts in with the news that Germany has surrendered in Europe. But Mr. Roberts is indifferent about the news, but he is overjoyed when Pulver tells him he'll celebrate by putting a powerful firecracker under the captain's bunk. However, while Pulver gathers his explosives, they go off in the bowels of the ship, causing the laundry to become flooded with soap suds.
It's actually the whole lower deck of the ship. It's flooded with soap.
Right. Yeah. It's hilarious. There's just like constant, just a big, a tidal wave of soap suds that just covers everything up. But Mr. Roberts is still overjoyed. He's really proud of Ensign Pulver. He thinks that Pulver could make another firecracker, but unfortunately, all of Pulver's supplies were destroyed in the accident. So he's forgiving of Pulver, but he goes out to be alone on the deck. How about this, Such Sean? Crazy,
scene. Huh? Again, a funny scene.
Chaos again.
It shakes the whole ship.
All right. So he goes out on the deck. As I mentioned, on the deck, the crew are listening to the radio broadcast of the Victory in Europe celebration coming in from New York City when Mr. Roberts arrives. And it's kind of a sad scene. Instead of staying and talking to him, which they might have done earlier, the men all leave. They just, one by one, they just go back to bed or just go off. And Roberts is left alone. Then the broadcast changes to a man giving an inspirational speech about how the war isn't over until the free world stands up to stupidity and arrogance. This is funny too. Mr. Roberts is moved by the speech and he marches up to the captain's palm trees. I know we say this over and over, folks, but it is hilarious. He's marching in perfect military strictness. You know, he does executes these turns and everything. He marches up the stairs, salutes the palm tree, picks it up and throws it overboard. And when the captain finds out, he sounds the ship's general alarm. And this, of course, musters the crew to their battle stations. They all think they're about to be attacked. And when they're all assembled, he demands to know who discarded his palm tree. After having his adjutant read the muster list, he determines that Roberts must be the culprit. So he calls Mr. Roberts to the captain's room, to his own room. But before he can even charge him with the crime, the captain is overcome with nausea. Roberts calls it. Yeah, go ahead.
He actually accuses Roberts of doing it and tells him that he's broken the agreement they made for Roberts to obey him even after he gave the men their liberty. But he doesn't realize that he has left the ship's intercom mic on because it's in his room.
That's important, yeah.
Yeah, so the crew actually hears about the sacrifice that Roberts made for them so that they could get a liberty.
Yes, very important detail there.
Yeah, that's when he realizes that the mic was on and then he's caught. And then that's when he starts having nausea and tries to throw up into his wastebasket.
Yeah, he's like, blah. But anyway, Roberts calls in the doc to help the captain. And as Sean said, he vomits into his own wastebasket. Doc puts the captain in his bunk to relax. And as Mr. Roberts walks down to the deck, the crew, knowing that he discarded the palm tree for them and that he made the sacrifice for them too, not just the palm tree, but they all salute him and they politely bid him good night. And then we see a few days later, Mr. Roberts is packing his things. The crew has actually forged the captain's name, approving a transfer for him, which will send him to the front line in the Pacific. Before he leaves, Dolan informs him that the captain has replaced the palm tree and has put a 24-hour guard on it. Doc and Roberts share a sorrowful goodbye, and as Roberts gets ready to meet the transfer vessel, a few of the crew give him a medal they'd made. And this is really a nice, touching gesture. It's a gaudy brass palm tree hanging from a ribbon. It's the Order of the Palm Tree. Roberts is overcome with gratitude, and he pins it to his shirt, and he walks with dignity out to the boat that will take him off the ship. He salutes the crewman and leaves. Thoughts, Sean? Commentary?
Just a good, nice scene there.
Yeah, it's touching. And of course, everybody that's watching the movie for the first time wonders what's going to happen next. So let's talk about what happens next. So several weeks later, Ensign Pulver has taken up Roberts' duties as deck officer, managing the moving of cargo. A few of the crew approach him and tell him that the captain has canceled the movie that was to be shown that night. What a surprise. Pulver reluctantly tells him that he'll do what he can. The ship's mail arrives and Pulver receives two letters. The first he reads is from Mr. Roberts, who seems happy that he's finally in the war and that his unit has been involved in 4 air raids. He talks about his brave crew that served him on the Reluctant and the ridiculous ribbon that they gave him. And then he reads the second letter. And the second letter is from a friend of Pulver's who is serving on the same ship as Roberts and has become friendly with him. And I should just quote him directly. He looks at the letter just for a second. And of course, this is a spoiler alert, but we spoiler alert. We do spoilers in all of our movie episodes. So if you don't want to know what happens, pause this, go watch the movie and come back. But he looks at the letter, and this is just, Jack Lemmon is so good. He looks up, looks the letter, looks up, and sadly just says, "Mr. Roberts is dead." And what has happened is that the ship suffered a surprise attack. Roberts was killed while drinking coffee. Pulver, of course, is overcome with grief. The chief petty officer wants to post the letter to inform the crew of Roberts' death. But Doc stops him, tells him to post the other letter, the letter that Roberts himself wrote, saying it belongs to them.
Yeah, and it was actually a kamikaze attack.
Right. Yeah.
I believe it was a destroyer that was on radar picket. The time frame after VE Day would have been Okinawa.
So
the destroyers, they had a lot of destroyers that got hit by kamikazes during that battle.
Right.
So, yeah, it is a very powerful moment. Just the look on Jack Lemmon's face, like you said, when his face just falls, you know, it's Jack Lemmon was such a rare actor. He was great at both comedy and drama, and he was able to blend and move between the two. You know, he totally deserves the Oscar for this movie. He deserved an Oscar for many of the movies that he was in. But yeah, he's just a remarkable actor, and love him. Absolutely love him. Fantastic actor, and just a beautiful scene. Really touching and very powerful.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Now, after this part, Pulver suddenly becomes enraged. He marches up to the palm tree. This is the replacement palm tree, of course, the second one. He grabs it, and he throws it overboard. And then he marches straight to the captain's quarters, banging on the door until he's told to enter. And he angrily confronts the captain. And he tells him that he just tells him, I threw the palm forward. And he demands why the movie has been canceled this evening. The captain then groans. He's knowing that he's going to have the same trouble with Pulver that he did with.
It's a little bit of comedy to lighten it up at the end.
Yeah, it is.
And apparently the palm tree incidents did occur on Hagar's ships, on the original author's ships. So that truly did apparently happen.
All right. Well, we made it through that one really quick, Sean. Yeah. Final thoughts.
Interesting notes. So John Ford, we've talked about quite a bit, and this will explain why John Ford and Mervyn LeRoy directed the film. So we've talked about John Ford's personality and his moods and his nature on the previous film on the They Were Expendable, but he was just noted for just a pretty foul attitude in general and being pretty abusive towards actors and towards crew, or not really towards crew, but really towards actors, being very tough on them and to the borderline abusiveness. And he didn't put up with any airs from anyone at all. He was in a really foul mood throughout the film. He had conflicts with Jimmy Cagney and Henry Fonda. Now, of course, we said Ford and Cagney had worked together once before on a film just a few years before, and there'd been no issues. But when John Ford picked Jimmy Cagney up at the airport, he told him, you and I are going to tangle asses on this picture. And which surprised Cagney because he didn't have any clue what he was talking about or what he never had a bad word with Ford. Cagney saw how rude and mean Ford was with the cast. And he was late to the set on the second day of shooting a few minutes. And Ford just launched into him and just started screaming and berating him. Cagney cut him short and said, when I started this picture, you said that we would tangle asses before this was over. I'm ready now. Are you? And Ford backed down and was on his best behavior, at least with Cagney, for the rest of the picture. So Cagney stood up to him because Cagney was not going to put up with it. And then, of course, he'd worked with Fonda on all those films and had gotten him the job. But they ended up getting into an argument as filming went on, because I think Fonda had some ideas about how he should play the role that he knew. And Ford wasn't going to have any of it. And so he ended up punching Fonda in the jaw. But then shortly after that, he ruptured his gallbladder. Shortly after that fight, he had to leave the film for a period for emergency surgery. So it could have been that he was feeling ill and it was just making him cranky. Who knows? So Mervyn LeRoy worked for the studios for Warner Brothers. We know Mervyn LeRoy from 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. He directed that film. So he stepped in to direct portions of the film while John Ford was out. And Jack Lemmon said in a DVD commentary, no one's really sure what scenes are Ford's and which ones are LeRoy's, because LeRoy actually studied John Ford's rushes, which is like the dailies, the filming that he filmed. And he tried to shoot those scenes that he knew, he tried to shoot those films that he directed as Ford would have directed. So it's hard to tell. You really can't tell which scenes were John Ford's and which were Mervyn LeRoy's. And actually, there's also some dialogue scenes that Henry Fonda convinced the studio to have reshot by the director and co-writer of the play. Fonda felt like they really needed some different takes on some of the shots. So they took, there's another director who was uncredited. So it was a kind of a complicated production as John Ford films could be. But yeah, that's the background. Yeah, I can just imagine Jamie Cagney and screwing up to John Ford.
It's interesting that you said that he ruptured his gallbladder and he had to be replaced temporarily. It's funny that he got injured in the other movie we talked about.
Exactly.
Too.
He had to be replaced
by Robert Montgomery.
Yeah. And actually, the interesting thing is that after this film, not a few years later, Jimmy Cagney played another naval hero, another character, a hero. He played the William F. Halsey in the film The Gallant Hours, which was directed by Robert Montgomery.
Small world.
Small world, yeah. But he didn't ever work for John Ford again.
No, and I imagine Henry Fonda probably didn't either, huh?
Henry Fonda did not either, although he did contribute to a documentary about him, like a celebration of his film career in the early 70s. Mm. He had kind words to say about him, but it didn't work.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This was such an influential play and movie that they made a later version, like a remake. Do you remember that one? 1984, there was a made-for-TV version, and I believe it was live, broadcast live.
Yeah, it was a live broadcast of the stage production.
Yeah, it had Robert Hayes was Mr. Roberts. Kevin Bacon was Ensign Pulver. I actually saw that. I saw that when it was broadcast live in 1984, but I hadn't seen the classic version until this year. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah. So they made a sequel to the film a few years later called Ensign Pulver. It starred Robert Walker, who we know from 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. He was the young crew chief on Van Johnson's plane. He played Ensign Pulver in the title role. They replaced Jimmy Cagney with Burl Ives, which we all should know who Burl Ives was. He was the voice of Frosty the Snowman.
Oh, yeah.
And actually a great actor. It was fantastic in The Big Country. And then they replaced Doc William Powell with Walter Matthau. So small world again. Walter Matthau was one of Jack Lemmon's most frequent partners and collaborators in films. And then the rest of the cast was rounded out by Larry Hagman, J.R. Ewing, James Coco, and a very, very young Jack Nicholson. So it's not funny. It's not funny as nearly as good as this film.
Huh.
And then they made a series, a TV series in the 1960s as well that really was not that good either. So I would say stick with this movie.
And imitation is the greatest form of flattery, but go with the original.
Yeah.
And what about the cast? You had a couple things to say?
Yeah, I mean...
Else?
Yeah, since it doesn't depict any real people, it's hard to say as far as casting goes. I think casting is outstanding in this film. Again, Henry Fonda is a little old to play the part, but it's his part. So I think I've said enough about that. Jack Lemmon is immaculately cast as Ensign Pulver. William Powell, if you're going to go out, have a really, a deep, sensitive role where you get to be funny and you get to do some acting. And Jimmy Cagney, yeah, he's Jimmy Cagney. So, if he's not playing, a song and dance man or a gangster. Well, I don't think there's anything else he can play as good as he does in this film. So,
did he have many films after this, or was this one of his last?
He had a couple of dozen films after this. He actually continued making films until about 1980 Ragtime, whatever year Ragtime. I think that was 80 or 82.
Something like that. That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah, he actually. Around this time, or maybe a little bit earlier, he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild as well. He has a famous story where he was trying to get the Screen Actors Guild to get the mob out of Hollywood. And so that was what he ran on his platform to run for president of the guild. And the mob started harassing him and they started calling him and threatening him. And they actually called his wife and said, "Where's your husband? Are you sure he's going to come home?" And so he actually reached out to his friend, an actor named George Rant. If you've seen Some Like It Hot, he plays the mobster in that film, Spats. George Rant was a real mobster. And so Jimmy Cagney reached out to him and asked him if he could help. And the calls stopped.
I bet they did.
So, yeah, George Rant was an actual real mobster in real life who had become a Hollywood actor. So, Cagney did a number of films. I don't think he'd won an Oscar in 1941 for Yankee Doodle Dandy, the film where he played George Cahan, which is, I just watched that recently and it's a fantastic film. So you should really check that one out. But he had some good, The Gallant Hours is a really, really good movie. He had some big films. I don't think he had a late career as great as someone like Spencer Tracy did, but he was very well respected, and he actually became very close friends with Jack Lemmon. They were lifelong friends after this film. Jack Lemmon, of course, you know, this was his, one of his early movies. He went on to win, this was his first Oscar. He won another Oscar for Save the Tiger. Of course, he was in Days of Wine and Roses and Some Like It Hot and the Oscar winning best picture film, The Apartment, which is one of my favorite movies ever. You know, he did Glengarry Glen Ross late in life. He did The China Syndrome, which is an amazing movie. He really should have won an Oscar for that one, too. So, yeah, he was one of the great Hollywood stars of the... I think you can kind of liken Jack Lemmon to Tom Hanks in terms of he was able to do comedy and drama with equal facility, and he was just a big star. And then Henry Fonda's film career was revived. He went on to star in a number of really, really great films. 12 Angry Men, I think we talked about a while back. He did that after this film. He did Advice and Consent. He did lots and lots of movies, but he didn't win an Oscar until his very last film, which was On Golden Pond.
On Golden Pond. I saw that one. That was a good one.
Yeah. But yeah, this was, you know, actually, Henry Fonda didn't directly work with John Ford, but he did work on films that John Ford worked on. So there were two films later that he was a part of that John Ford was also a part of. He was in How the West Was Won, and John Ford directed a segment of that. It just didn't have Henry Fonda in it. And then he was also in The Longest Day, where he plays General Theodore Roosevelt Jr. And John Ford contributed some to the directing of that film, too.
All right. Well, that's a good wrap up. Now we're down to the part that our listeners are dying to to see, to hear, the part you've been waiting for. This is the part where Sean and I rate the film from 1 to 5 stars. I wonder what Sean is going to rate it.
I mean, this is a 5. This is a 5-star film, easy for me.
But I am going to follow suit. I'm going to also give it a 5. It's magnificent. Every time I watched it, it grew on me even more. I liked it better.
It's funnier every time you watch it.
It really is.
It doesn't get boring either. And it's 2 hours. I didn't realize it was 2 hours long.
Does it seem shorter?
Yeah, it moves very fast. And so, yes. I mean, it's not like, it doesn't move fast like an action movie fast, but it just moves along at a very good pace. So you don't really notice the time. I mean,
yeah, it does go by really fast. And I can watch this one with my wife. You know, there's no combat at all. So
no, exactly.
All right. Well, that wraps up Mr. Robert. Next week, we will be discussing the third of our 19th classic naval combat movies, or naval movies, I should say. No combat in this one, but there will be definitely combat in the next one. That is the submarine movie from 1958 called Run Silent, Run Deep, starring Clark Gable and Burt Lancaster. We'll see you then. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lem, and Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are 4 things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are 5 different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabres, Anna Concepcion Castro, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier,
Scott Hendricks, Who's Your Daddy, David Luisa, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.